The following story is from Beatty's Americana, Volume 1, Number 15. This is a little self-published art zine of sorts that is just too complicated to go into right now. Copyright 1990 by James Beatty. And the date on the editorial, well, I guess it's dated. The editorial note is dated. I don't know if the dream took place then or if it was a little bit earlier, but I know that according to the editorial matter, the dream must have taken place sometime in late spring, very late spring of 1989. So here it is. Thursday, June 22nd, 89, 12:17 a.m. Editor's note. The following dream took place the day after I finished my Millennium painting. It was also the day after I first heard about the congressional arts controversy. It was also the day after China's government began executing those arrested during the student demonstrations at Tiananmen Square. The arts controversy, by the way, was the whole Mapplethorpe thing that happened in Congress with the National Endowment for the Arts that year. Anyway, here's the story read by Goblin Hood. A foxtrot in bondage or anything for love. Me and my pal Dweeb were lounging around at the AMPM cafe, sucking on cancer sticks, sucking down Java, and sucking up the both of us to this really stellar waitress known to her close friends as the 21st Century Fox, or just Fox. We were strenuously vying for her favors and attentions, contesting at her command over which of us would get to trail her home and submit to her various whims. I knew from the start that Dweeb was out of the running because he was such a dweeb. But then I was a dweeb too, so I gave the matter my best shot just to be safe. And there we were, just a couple of dweebs sitting on stools like school dunces, bickering and competing for the dubious privilege of doing whatever the fox wanted. Dweeb may have been a greenhorn, but I knew exactly what I was getting into. I was a veteran of the 21st Century Fox, and so the competition reminded me a lot of stories about Aztec or Mayan football teams beating the crap out of each other so that the captain of the winning team could be sacrificed right there on the field. Could have his living heart ripped out, I guess, and eaten by the priests. Yeah, the fox was like that, predatory. By day, Fox was basically a lackluster, frumpy waitress. By night, though, in her own haunt, she transmogrified into a grim, glistening creature of elegant menace and sinister attraction, a spiky apparition of spectral mystery whose tastes ran to nail-studded leather and silk, and whose best friend was a vibrating chrome dildo named Squealy Man, in honor of the great literary figure William Burroughs. Yeah, just thinking about the fox could make your asshole quiver with fear and desire. But I was in love with this woman, and so I was reduced to a kind of slobbering gratitude for any attention whatsoever that she chose to pay me. Besides, she was cute. As for Dweeb, I think he just wanted to fuck her, the poor sap. Little did the chump know. Anyway, I won the contest, of course, by being smarmier, oilier, and more fawningly ingratiating. Dweeb couldn't understand why I was brown-nosing the fox. Dweeb, the sad, deluded fool, was convinced that she secretly just wanted to be pushed around by a man. So I won. But in the course of wooing her, I was obliged to eat a lot of horrendous diner food, including the following loathsome entree, rancid fishheads with cold, clotted, maggoty macaroni and cheese all floating around in a gallon of brine. I figured that after this scrumptious repast, my usual obligatory late snack of fox anus would probably taste like ambrosia. Usually it just tasted like candy, bittersweet, dark chocolate, perhaps. Anyway, I got to taste the difference within a short time. The fox dragged me home by the hair and put the cuffs on me. They weren't attached to anything, though. I just wore them like bracelets. The fox knew what a wimp I was, and so she never tied me up or used any of her lethal-looking whips on me. She would sometimes spank my ass with her hand while screwing me until my cheeks turned as red as my face, or until I started snivelling, whichever came first. As for tying me up, the fox knew it scared me half to death, rapidly breaking down my personality to a state bordering on sheer psychosis, even in fun. And hell, we were only in this racket for fun, right? The fun began when the fox climbed into her armor-plated, spiked leather bodysuit with mask, conveniently open at the front and back, in fact, crotchless. Then she wrapped her lush buttocks around my face, and I got to worship there for a while. Cleverly, the fox decided to let me fuck her first, figuring I'd probably come in no time and we could get to the good part. She smeared me with some sweet-smelling lubricant and then scampered over to a kind of altar with chains and cushions. She draped herself over this in manacles, her legs spread wide and her ass elevated by a mountain of pillows, her sultry brown eye fairly winking at me. As she figured, the act didn't take long, but while it did last, while I was still buried in her hot little cornhole, plugging away in search of ecstasy, I couldn't help thinking how romantic this was and how beautifully close we were in those few moments. The act was fast and furious, but it seemed like a slow dance accompanied by an infinite dreamy melody. And though the act climaxed with me transfigured to a quasi-bestial state, wordlessly growling and snarling and clawing the air in a demonic frenzy while I shot spunk up her rump, at the same time I was transported, we both were, aloft on the clouds, in a feverish rapture of satiated lust. She cried out, and her buttocks flexed and stiffened as she came. Most of all, I marveled at the strangeness of the act, and at the knowledge that this was what passed for tenderness between us. Neither of us was emotionally equipped for conventional romance, and so this frantic, violent passion was basically as close as we could get to expressing physical love for each other. Besides, it never lost its dubious charm. It invariably excited the shit out of both of us. But then the fox put her asshole away, and it was my turn. Fancying that she saw tears of nervous apprehension in my eyes, my lady fox offered me drugs with a smirk. I looked through her stash. Hell, most of this stuff is legal, I thought, in veiled contempt. Still, she had some primo rust pot, cultivated it set on Mars, and a few hits of treasonol, a drug so illegal you can be shot on sight for mere possession. But she was out of those spiffy Novocaine suppositories like she had last time. She probably stuffed them up her ass, I thought wistfully, preparing to just top it out. I'd show her I had guts as big time as she did. Fox dressed me in a lacy silk evening gown, wearing a stunningly realistic latex mask of her own face. She broke out Squealy Man and brandished it like a secret weapon, caressing it like a long-lost lover, crooning softly to it like an invocational lullaby for a beloved familiar. Squealy Man ran on industrial-strength batteries and could achieve light speed. The calibrations on its dial simply read up, up, and away. At least it amounted to safe sex. She strapped the thing on and pulled my long gown up and behind, loosely and symbolically tying my arms with it. I tried not to whimper at even this pretended level of restraint. She greased my rectum with some fragrant goo, and then I felt her cold, pulsating adventure knocking at my back door. "Shit the bed," I choked out as she ran the spastic thing way up inside of me. Then I was speechless, trying to keep from screeching as Fox and her crony little pal gave me the kind of hardcore reaming she probably thought I deserved. I guess she played with herself while she had me impaled there, because eventually I could hear the falsetto gasps and half wails that always heralded her own orgasms. I could sense her relaxing, though her accomplice was stiffer than ever. I squirmed, still transfixed, forbidden by rule to use my hands. Instead, she reached around and stroked my rampant, engorged meat. At her mere touch, I came all over everything and spoiled my lovely silk gown. She smacked my buns sharply as she slowly withdrew her trusty bionic prick, which I then had to take into the bathroom and wash. I was just lucky she didn't make me kiss the slimy little fucker. Later, we reclined languidly, smoking some of her Martian herb and just basking in each other's arms like two lovers after a tryst. Time slowed as the pungent red smoke permeated my nervous system, and I watched the fox absently twist her pubic hair into little spikes. It wasn't just the drug that made my heart melt with syrupy love for this crusty little hellion. She had class. But then we made the mistake of turning on the television. The latest dream news from China was on the screen. They were having a parade, carrying with great honor the bodies of slain soldiers from the People's Army. They also carried long stakes, to which were nailed the heads, torsos, and whatnot of executed students. I woke up in sheer disgust at the obscenity of it all. To give a little more perspective, I don't know what I thought. I don't know what Beatty thought he was doing with his little newsletter. It was barely published at all, usually in editions of 15 to 40 copies, and distributed however he could. In the course of it, he actually had one subscriber, believe it or not. Every other issue, and I guess this was a reaction to the so-called arts controversy, every other issue was like what I just read, although that was probably the sleaziest story that he put in there. In fact, it was from his celebrated special maximum sleaze issue. For whatever it's worth, he did say at the top of these stupid things, "For mature adults only." The AM/PM Cafe, though, was sort of a joke from another dream that had been published in an earlier issue. However, the dream itself took place later than the last one did. By the way, most of the stories in this little periodical were about his dreams. That's one of the things Beatty was busy doing, was cataloging his dreams. This next thing was from volume 1, number 5, Beatty's Americana, blah blah, read by Goblin Hood, of course. And it starts out with, there's a dream about nuclear war that I'll get to on some other tape, but after that, it has this little, it has the following little, intro. Finally, this refreshing change of pace. Bisexual necrophiliac party time, AM/PM. with Death Bird. 1390, 8:45 p.m. I guess it must be later than we think. I just dreamed of this weird clock. It was kind of like a glass dome with little figures in it, reminding me of a music box. One of the figures was a skeletal bird, dipping its beak up and down forever like a perpetual motion machine, keeping the time with its rhythm. The other two figures exchanged positions at noon and midnight. Both were, again, skeletal caricatures. Somehow one was clearly male, and the other as clearly female, though neither seemed to possess visible sex organs. They took turns humping each other from behind in an act of skeletal sodomy. A.M. was his, P.M. was hers. Both seemed to enjoy each aspect of their bizarre relationship in a spectral sort of way. Oddly, all three figures wore little party hats. Perhaps they were all on drugs as well. In any case, they were really whooping it up there in Clockland. Maybe this was like some kind of Mardi Gras, a farewell to flesh. Or maybe they were just saying, bugger death. Goblinhood again. You might wonder why I'm putting my own stories on the other side of this Joyce Carol Oates tape. The reason is that none of the stories of hers that I really want would be short enough to fit into the space that's left. Also, I wanted to see just how long it would take to read one of my stories. And turns out they're a lot shorter than they look on the paper. As the date, the 3rd of January, 1990, would suggest, that bisexual necrophiliac party time dream was shortly after a long and frenzied New Year's Eve that I had spent working on an issue of the newsletter. The newsletter ran from about, November of 1989 to about late spring of 1990. So, it's like that. I guess it's also reasonable to say that because the Joyce Carol Oates story had so much to do with sexual dreams, these Beati dreams are presented as a sort of contrast. By the way, the stories are taken from, they're being read from the newsletter itself, of which I have exactly one copy of each, but they were taken to put in there. They were taken from journals that Beati kept, and that's why the dates are always so spot on. He was always meticulous about recording his dreams at certain points. Doesn't do it much anymore, but then doesn't dream much anymore. There seems to be a correlation there. Anyway, here's another one from, actually here's a couple or so from volume 1, number 8. And it's under the heading of Dream Sleaze. Friday, April 8th, 1988. Circa 3 a.m. But this is so that tonight. I dreamed about being a vampire in a jail cell. Probably I'd been arrested for drugs, possibly even for possession of the near mythical drug treasonol. With me was the sheriff, the same police chief who fled town in the TV adaptation of Stephen King's vampire classic Salem's Lot. The sheriff and I were going to play marbles for my ass. He was equipped with Aggie's cat's eyes and an industrial strength jar of Vaseline. I didn't even have a chastity belt. but I knew we were playing for keeps. And I was playing for time, verbally trying to play down the sexual attraction of my twitching sphincter, hoping for some lucky shots. I was probably suffering withdrawal from my blood Jones, too. I woke up with a strange and forgotten thought in my mind, a strange combination of words about how the something is so something tonight. Also, my right arm was totally asleep, to the point of being numb, but my asshole, fortunately enough, was nice and tight and impregnable. Following that, Thursday, May 5th, 1988, circa 9:30 p.m., locomotive sex, or basic training. I had a voyeuristic dream the other night about a woman I know only by sight. In my dream, she was my neighbor. She was young, very attractive, of Asian descent, and a closet doper. She was also bisexual. I knew these last facts because in my dream, I had recently orgied with her and a girlfriend of hers amid acts of vaginal, penile, anal, oral, and even more esoteric sex. AM, PM, using dildos, weird costumes, and weird bondage gear. We had also lavishly smoked marijuana and snorted cocaine. Anyway, the woman, Maya, had recently joined the U.S. Armed Forces. As it happened, I could see into her bedroom from my window. Without intending to pry, I witnessed her bringing an anonymous man into her boudoir, undressing and performing an act of sodomy. Oddly enough, as he was butt-knocking her, she began scrambling forward on all fours, and suddenly they both took off out of sight with great speed and force, very much like a train barreling along. I got the impression that they were no longer in the room. It was sort of like the Brown Speedway or the Rectum Express, I guess. Later, Maya's girlfriend, Mara, told me it had all been a setup. The Army wanted to bust Maya for being a bisexual Asian doper, but couldn't get proof. In my dream, even consensual sodomy was illegal, so they used it as a pretext to spirit Maya away to detention somewhere. Mara and I spent the rest of the dream trying to locate and rescue our friend and lover, to no avail. Sleaze note, the reference to AM/PM sex goes back to a story in issue number 5. It's a joke at the expense of the author, who is unashamedly queer for women. Right. Well, you've already heard the AM/PM dream, so judge for yourselves. This next one isn't about sex, but it's in the same issue. And the dream itself is months later. Anyway, it goes like this. Friday, November 4th, 1988, 9:37 p.m. Cannibalism among friends. A wild dream this morning. I was a cannibal chief with two friends. One was a combination cook / doctor / and public executioner. I'm not sure what the other was, but he was a close friend and extremely ill. We'll call him Buddy. I told Bones, the cook, doctor, executioner, to take care of Buddy, meaning, of course, to administer to Buddy's medical needs. But later I discovered that I'd been tragically misunderstood. Bones thought I meant that Buddy was a criminal and had executed him. Now Bones was preparing Buddy for dinner. As I watched, he chopped an arm off, then a leg. Then with one vertical stroke of the axe, he cleaved Buddy's torso in twain, vertically. Oddly, as I watched Buddy's entrails tumble and slither out, I was reminded of the wisdom of Solomon. In any case, a mistake had been made. I hauled my remaining pal, Bones, off to the side for a little chat. I don't know how it came out, but I know I didn't want to offend him. I had already lost one friend. Would I now lose another? Anyway, having run out of stories short enough to read in what's left of this tape, I'm going to present some of the less sleazy aspects of this harmless art presentation, as Beatty's Americana was self-styled. This is from Volume 1, Number 13. By the way, there was only one volume. Anyway, it starts with a guest editorial that goes like this. There is, however, a strong empirical reason why we should cultivate thoughts that can never be proved. It is that they are known to be useful. Man positively needs general ideas and convictions that will give a meaning to his life and enable him to find a place for himself in the universe. He can stand the most incredible hardships when he is convinced that they make sense. He is crushed when, on top of all his misfortunes, he has to admit that he is taking part in a tale told by an idiot. Carl G. Jung, Approaching the Unknown. No, Approaching the Unconscious. Sorry about that. Which is followed by a really nice little illustration of an oscillating universe approximately 80 billion years from start to finish, or rather from start to beginning. Which, by the way, most of the illustrations in here are reduced so small that they can barely be, you know, figured out, but that wasn't Beatty's fault. He was trying to use as much of the four pages in his newsletter as he could. Anyway, the lead article in this issue is as follows. Let there be light, or what really happened to the dinosaurs anyway? A science article by James Beatty. Science is less a religion than a joust where scientists seek to prove each other's crackpot theories wrong. Science never accepts anything as fact until it can be duplicated and studied at will. One such anomaly is the creation of the universe. We can't duplicate it or study it. We can't know. Though physics research with particle accelerators takes us closer and closer to the conditions of the primal instant until we can duplicate exact conditions of before that event, we're still just talking about shrapnel. Naturally, the origin of the shrapnel concerns us in that it might hint at the ultimate fate of the shrapnel. Meanwhile, we are the shrapnel. One theory holds that the universe oscillates, that is, flares up, fades, and flares up again, a process lasting 80 billion years each time, plus whatever downtime occurs between manifestations. The steady state theory, on the other hand, seems to hold that things have always been in their present form and will go on. Somehow that sounds almost as mystical as creationism, but that's the point. Until we can duplicate, study, and understand what happened, all such theories are pretty mystical. One view of the universe, perhaps a form of the steady state postulation, is that it is simply expanding constantly forever. If that's true, then it stands to reason that things are getting bigger and bigger all the time. This might explain what really happened to the dinosaurs. It's been speculated that they were wiped out by a comet or frozen out by an ice age, or even that they got so big they couldn't feed themselves. Maybe due to the millions of years of expansion since then, they just got so big that we can't see them anymore. Or they may have stayed the same size in relation to their world, in which they were supposedly the biggest life forms around. And maybe they're still around, except that due to the millions of expansive years I mentioned, their whole world has gotten so minute now in relation to our big world that now the dinosaurs are so tiny that we can't detect them at all, even though they might be swarming everywhere, perhaps desperately trying to get our attention, assuming they could even notice things as big as us. This might explain what all those big dinosaur skeletons are doing all over the place. Perhaps they were cleverly faked and planted where we would find them by the now microscopic dinosaurs in a successful attempt to show us how big they would have been if they were around now. For that matter, maybe the conniving little tricksters are lying to us about their actual size. But this theory would at least help explain why we haven't found any more of the skeletons than we have. If the dinosaurs are as diminutive as I'm hypothesizing, then it would have taken them those millions of years just to fabricate the few huge skeletons that we have so far. Why did they even bother? And how did they know we'd be so interested? And why are they so busy trying to deceive us, eh? Frankly, I don't care what they're up to. I just plain don't trust the devious little scalawags, and I say, if we can find them, we should stamp them out. Note, the Carl Jung quote was from Man and His Symbols, page 76, copyright 1964, edited by Carl G. Jung and others, Dell Publishing, New York. And as a kind of half-assed postscript to that dinosaur routine, I'm gonna include this following little article, or part of an article, from the Acme Art Mag. Hold on just a minute. Yeah, this is the Acme Art Mag from April of 1994. This was a much more real publication than Beatty's Arcana or Beatty's Americana, and it, at the time, it was including a horoscope predicted by Goblin Hood and the Marcin Tarot, as well as usually a little article, sometimes involving science. I'm going to read the article because it involves the dinosaurs. Goblin Hood presents good news, bad news. Good news: I'm not trying to sell you memberships this month, even though the gallery is desperate for you to buy one. It really needs the money. Bad news: Jack Kirby, the Elvis of Overground Comics, died back in February. Creator of numerous titles like The Demon and The Eternals, and co-creator of The Fantastic Four and The Incredible Hulk, he was a giant in the industry. Unfortunately, he never got the chance to draw Goblin Hood. For that matter, John Candy just bought the farm too and blew his chances of ever portraying Goblin Hood in the movies. Good news: that comet still won't hit the Earth in July, but I now hear that it will hit Jupiter with X times the impact of Earth's total nuclear capacity. I wonder if that's retroactive. Other scientific news: a new theory postulates that the dinosaurs weren't wiped out by a comet strike or whatever, but that they simply ran out of air. I can see that. They were probably flatulent in a big way, and their carcasses were much too big to bury after death. Besides, there were no undertakers around. So after stinking up all their available air, the dinosaurs all died. Case closed. Good news for modern man: the second crucifixion of Goblin Hood will take place on Good Friday, and with any luck, it will really work this time, and GH will stay dead. If not, April Fools. Ha ha ha. This article includes a little advertisement Cafe Ashtray presents the second crucifixion of Goblinhood. Good Friday, April 1st. And underneath that it says, the second greatest story ever told. Yeah, well, you know, the second crucifixion wasn't nearly as successful as the first, and sad to say, neither of them really worked, or Goblinhood would not be here reading this. But I'm gonna, like, finish the tape by reading horoscopes for April, predicted by Goblinhood and the Marcin Tarot. Aquarius, if you find the right god, you could wind up owning a car dealership or something. Pisces, you might win your heart's desire, which might involve becoming a prize-winning prize fighter. Aries, if you follow your dream, the entire world will blossom for you. Doesn't that sound sappy? But it's true. Taurus, spiritual guidance might counsel patience, or perhaps you'll have to wait in line to conform at the workplace. Gemini, your fortunes won't stop you from wandering off into the desert to seek inner peace. Cancer, if you ask my advice, you should spend more time with yourself and get lots of rest. Leo, things might get a little rough for a while, but isn't it worth it if the world gets handed to you after that? Virgo, I know you're waiting for your ship to come in, but is that any reason not to celebrate? Party down, clown. Libra, remember that dealing with lots of money can make you become too materialistic. Don't wear the devil's collar, nor let the beast out to play. Scorpio, you may hear something new about your work soon, so try not to be too scatterbrained, especially if you should happen to fall in love. Sagittarius, even if you're afraid to take chances, the perfect match for you exists out there. Check it out, if you dare. Capricorn, while tragedy may have stalked your past, the sheer valor within you can help you come out on top. These horoscopes, by the way, were like Beatty used, or Goblinhood actually, I used three different tarot decks, including my own hand-painted deck, plus the deck that it was modeled after, the Waite Rider deck designed by Pamela Coleman Smith, plus a deck designed by Aleister Crowley. I would lay out all three decks for each month and then try to interpret each month. Got a card from each deck, that's what it was. Yeah, so for each, not each month, but each horoscope sign, got one card from each deck, and then I would like read the cards together and try to figure out what they were saying from there. And so, you know, your fortunes won't stop you from wandering off into the desert to seek inner peace. I'm not sure what the first couple of cards would have been, but I know that the last one is, I think it's a Seven of Cups or something, that shows like somebody kind of wandering into the desert to seek inner peace, kind of a spiritual card. I'm not sure it's a Seven of Cups, but it's one of them. And through there, it might be the Eight of Cups. I can tell the cards when I look at them, but I can't remember them offhand like this. So this tape is going on longer than I thought, which basically means that the stuff that, of my own that I'm reading is shorter than I thought. And that's good. It means if I want to go on reading that stuff on the tape, I'll be able to get a lot more of it on each tape. I'm hoping for an influx of new tapes pretty soon so that I can go on doing this. If not, I've got just, I don't know, three or four left to do before I have to stop and start painting again. And they range from, there's one that's going to be about spiders because I'm painting spiders. There's one that's going to be about nuclear war because I'm going to be painting nuclear explosions. As noted before, most of them have to do with sex, particularly really sleazy sex, which is where these the Adi Americana things come in pretty handy, because the sex gets fairly sleazy there. I'm going to try to resist actually reading anything by Marquis de Sade or any of that. The Oates story, Joyce Carol Oates story, that got downright sadistic, sadomasochistic or something in places. But one of the reasons I threw in my dinosaurs rip, because it was talking about part of the same scientific stuff she was talking about, you know, the whole idea of finding out what the universe was doing right after it was created, or just before it was created, or like that. My science is probably kind of like half-assed, and interestingly, since 1990, which was when that was written, I think a lot of stuff has changed. I think things like the Hubble telescope have been really starting to attack either the oscillating universe theory or the steady state universe theory. I'm not sure which is less in vogue right now. But my dinosaur theory still stands. You know, the sly little buggers are around somewhere, I'm sure of it. They're watching everything we do, and, you know, they probably don't like us any better than we like them. But they're probably proud of movies like, you know, Jurassic Park. By the way, I wanted to do a cartoon called Jurassic Clark, where the only dinosaur left on Earth, which mysteriously has superpowers, gets a job as a newspaper reporter named Jurassic Clark. And in its off moments, when there's an emergency, it goes flying away dressed up as Super Sore and saves the day. Meanwhile, there could be like Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen hanging around the newspaper office wondering why Jurassic Clark and Super Sore are never seen anywhere at the same time. The joke, of course, being that he's the only dinosaur around, for God's sake. But, you know, I mean, who the hell's going to publish a comic like that? If Beatty's Americana was still around, believe me, it would. Meanwhile, I've enjoyed this. I'm going to do at least one other tape, I think, based on my own work, while I've still got any to work with the tapes, because I kind of enjoy having my own stuff go down like this. Maybe this is what I should have been doing all along, I don't know. But I've always kind of been self-conscious about my own writings, for instance. It's just, I looked up that Joyce Carol Oates story because it was so explicit and so kind of like ugly in some ways. And it's to remind myself that I'm not the only person who writes out this kind of stuff and calls it literature. And besides, like when you're talking about your dreams, what can you say? I threw in Carl Jung because I want to like make it clear that this is a study of the human mind. You know, I don't know what Joyce Carol Oates was doing, but I know that what I was doing was trying to like, and what I am doing with the paintings, particularly the triptych, I'm trying to study the Adi, goblinhood, whatever. We're trying to study what we can of the human mind using the only subject that we have at hand. It's a kind of a vivisection of the soul. And if the results are sort of ugly, and Grib, well, you know, so would be an autopsy, but how else are you going to get to the truth? How else do we learn? The proper study of man is supposed to be man. So these dreams, they're speaking of a world we don't have normal access to. And Beati has brought rumors of a